Well, hi, everybody. I hope you guys are all doing great. I want to depart a little bit from what we've been doing, mostly in response to some of the questions you've asked, and to have a discussion. I know that, you know, my preference certainly is to do a seminar with a discussion, but I feel an obligation to provide a lot of information, which doesn't allow us enough time to talk. I would like to begin our last seminar next week with some questions that we'll discuss about applying the mind and brain sciences to inform co-creative collaboration and communication, practical ways to address how you can help clients, for example, change their mind. How can you ask the best questions? How can communication be more effective? Why not focus on problems initially in order to resolve them and move beyond them? How do you begin a conversation that can make a difference? How can mental framing determine outcome? I'll send these around in an email as prompts for a discussion and devote a portion of our time to that and then condense what we're going to talk about from the outline and from what I've planned. I can consolidate that to make that more practical. So any thoughts or questions at this point or things you'd like to add to the hopper for us to discuss or even for right now? Any comments about anything you've heard or want to be sure you hear? Well, let me respond to a couple of the comments more recently from your emails. And again, thank you very much for the kind words and responses. Remember that each of your clients do not experience their story as a story, but it's just the way things are. It's reality. I talk about story as a metaphor for the coaching conversation, for the client's story or whatever aspect of that, whether it's a life or work or wellness or career or money story. We talk about it as a story, as a way of helping us organize, us as coaches, organize a way of thinking and interacting with a client to help them elaborate about what can help them create a better story. And actually, Margaret Atwood said it really clearly in her book, Alias Grace. When you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered woods. While our lives rarely follow a clear linear path, they're nonetheless experienced as a series of episodes, but only in retrospect. And sometimes only with a mentor coach do these episodes have a beginning, middle, and end. And does it seem like a story rather than just day to day? So these are important things for us to remember, I think. And one other notable writer here, Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and philosopher in the 1600s, knew the answer, the initial answer at least, to how do you get someone to change? He said, well, people are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they themselves discovered than by those which have come into the minds of others. So his answer, we'll explore this in more detail and more informed by the Mind and Brain Sciences next time. His answer was simply, don't tell them to change. Evoke the reasons for change that are already in their mind and brain to support those. So the point of reference is the client. They're the protagonist of their story, not changing it to our story. So that begins empathic resonance with the experience of the client being central. Now, anything you'd like to add or ask or reference to be sure we talk about as we proceed? Well, feel free, as always, to email me things that you think about or clarifications, and we'll have more of an open mic at the beginning next time to discuss some of these things and see if this really fits with what is applicable and helpful to you, which is my purpose in doing this. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I'll come back at the end with any questions or clarifications. So we're talking about mindset during this seminar. And recall from last seminar, a state of mind is like a software program that can determine what we perceive, how we process information, how we respond. And our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. Mindsets frame the ongoing account of how we interpret, how we process, of what we do. Let me give you a simple example of a mindset. Think about, here's a question or a comment. This is the title of a book. Don't think of an elephant. So what does that immediately do? It frames what you think about. One of my favorite authors, social scientist George Lakoff, it ensures you'll think about an elephant. Whether the focus is negative or positive, it activates the imagery of the elephant. You can't not think about it. We get what we focus on. And neuroscience and quantum physics show us that it's what we focus on, not what we want necessarily. And that focus can be determined in a number of ways to enhance performance. This is some of what I want to have in a discussion next time, but words can activate a particular brain mindset. Our brains are structured to link a particular word or concept or emotion with what mindset, what software program is booted up to deal with it. For example, one of the things that we know is that the first words in a conversation can boot up a mindset that processes the remainder of the conversation. If those first words are perceived as words that are collaborative, words of connection in some way, a mindset that includes the mediation by oxytocin, the neurochemical system of bonding and connection, becomes activated. If those first few words are perceived as judgmental or critical or pejorative, it boots up a mindset that's mediated by an entirely different neurochemical system that's geared toward protection and caution, questioning about trust, but it's a self-protective mindset. So the first few words boot up that mindset. So this is exactly what we're doing in beginning with the client, to ask the client what the client wants to focus on. We began with asking them in a collaborative way to establish that collaborative framework, what they want to co-create together. And that becomes determined by, the client takes ownership of that story that's going to unfold. And then we ask the client where the client wants to get to, so that the beginning and the end, the map, the two coordinates, are determined by the client. Then we collaboratively proceed. But that framework of collaboration is distinctly different than anything else, any other professional engagement. Think about how the consultative mindset and framework is different. You go to a physician, you talk about issues, problems, and the physician tells you what to do. It's not a collaborative arrangement. What we do is the co-creation of a new story or an evolving story for the client. So this is important to think about this from the very beginning. The mindset establishes everything else that follows. For example, if there's a framing of a particular experience, say you experience something that is new and different, and understandably, this is going to be the trepidation that someone experiences when something is new and different, because the error detection mechanism says this is not right. Departing the default mode means there's a discomfort, an uncertainty. If that uncertainty is read as this is a mistake, this is not right, or this is danger, I better head back for cover, instead of framed as opportunity, as excitement. So the brain, right at that juncture, that instant, can't tell the difference. The brain registers the same stimulus, the same way for excitement or anxiety. So how we frame it determines how someone proceeds. If it's framed as excitement and challenge and opportunity, then there's an engagement of a very different part of the brain system. New connections are made to look at possibility. If, for example, it's framed as a problem rather than an opportunity, it travels down an existing pathway, and it further etches that problem. Even if you find a better solution, even 1,000 better solutions later, you still have etched the pathway a little bit further, and this is how people get stuck sometimes in therapy or counseling, or go over the same problems because they simply know where it's going to end up, and that can register as effectiveness to have it be predictable. But you know where that problem and the solution for it, the discussion about it, is going to end. So mindset comes first. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach to any cue or stimulus, and then the meaning determines behavior. So to change your behavior, you may have to change the meaning that you attach. Here's an example of that. Self-directed neuroplasticity. This is a way you can change your mind and change your brain. So, when you treat any mistake or defeat or focus or fumble as an error message from your brain, any, let's say, negative self-talk, you know, I don't have the time, I can't do this, whatever that negative message is from your brain, first step is to recognize this is the job description of your brain. It's trying to protect you from danger. So first, that's the default method of the brain. So what do? You recognize it as an error message from your brain in this new and different, maybe challenging, opportunity or possibility. So there are three R's to this thing. This is real simple. Recognize it as an error message from your brain, and then pause to reframe it. What's the challenge? What's the opportunity here? What's a possibility instead of a problem? Remember, I mentioned that with every mentor coaching client, I sometime during that first discussion, usually the first coaching session, I will ask permission to interrupt if I believe that it might be helpful for us to look at something at that moment. And when they grant me permission, I grant them permission to interrupt me, and because I want to be interrupted if there's something that doesn't make sense. So immediately when the client begins with, well, here's a problem, that's a moment of interruption. When we then refocus, what's the opportunity here? Now, that assumes you both have some understanding, but it's a shift from problem to possibility. So that's the reframe to look at. And there's not going to be any answers in place necessarily, but you begin to look at possibilities. And then the third R, after recognize error message, reframe, is to refocus. With the reframing, what's the first step? Create a systematic way to proceed there. Remember, the simple coaching model is a system. The two coordinates of the map, where somebody is, where they want to go, you're collaboratively engaging together to pursue that and to get there, determined by the client. So the refocus here is on the next step so that the client knows what to do instead of feel overwhelmed at all the possibilities. It's like, you know, one day, even though I've done this hundreds and hundreds of times with clients, she walked into my office, and I said, what's going on? I said, I've just got so many things. And she spun around on her left foot, and before her right foot hit the ground, she said, just pick one. And, of course, she was right. And when I did, things got a lot clearer. So that's exactly what we do with clients, just pick one. So this is a way to recognize, reframe, and refocus. This is a way, when that's repeated, that is self-directed neuroplasticity. Because whatever we think about most will dominate our emotional state of mind and even affect our confidence. So what we think about will determine what you experience. What you think about right now will determine what you experience right now. And focus can give a level of confidence that allows you to proceed. And remember, one of the assumptions that can be very limiting is I got to be confident before I can move ahead, or I need to be comfortable before I can launch into this. Those are limiting assumptions. So this is about beginning, because simply from a mind and brain perspective, when it's something new and different, you're not going to begin with feeling comfortable or feeling confident. It's a place you get to, but you have to proceed despite that in order to move ahead. So let's look a little bit at mind maps, about the brain story. The brain connections or mind maps can influence the reality that we see. A paradigm is roughly synonymous with a mind map. It's a model, a theory, or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our heads. Our storylines, we're often unaware of having, assuming we see things the way they are. So these paradigms then can determine how we perceive, how we structure meaning, how we think and behave. So we originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world, and these beliefs then become predictors and confirm the reality that generates them. Let me give just a brief example. Some of you have heard this story before. This is a study out of London a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were selected to spend the year in different ape colonies. The anthropologists had no communication with each other during this time and then emerged to compare results. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony, achieved a comfort and unity with the apes, and got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony, remained careful and vigilant, always seemed like right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved that comfort and harmony. The anthropologists and their teams could not understand these discrepant results because they were chosen because of their similarity of personality, philosophy, training, and they expected remarkable similarities instead of these significant differences. They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, never achieved her real comfort, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. So a belief is an anatomical reality in our brain. That's why you can't just tell somebody a new fact or information or data and expect it to overwrite whatever fact or data or even belief that's already there. We'll talk about that more next time. So a belief is a feeling of certainty. So to get someone's belief, you say, well, how do you really know that? And as coaches, we listen for limiting beliefs that may ghostwrite behaviors. So this is where we establish a collaborative framework to be able to get away with saying what we need to say if you think about 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious. Much of what we hear from our clients will be from that automatic default mode. So that is what is expected. That's the default mode. That's what is the normal story without being a story for the client. So what we do as coaches then is at times in certain select ways to break that script. We may ask about a behavior or ask for something that's left out when someone is talking about what they're thinking, what they're doing, what's left out. What were you feeling as you were thinking and doing that? Or how did you decide to do that? We hear something that a client goes from A to B to D. How were you thinking about it to decide what you did? To develop in some way self-reflection and self-awareness, because that's the basis of then self-regulation, to not react, but instead to be grounded and centered and to respond. So here's an example. Let me give you first. If you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. For example, if you feel bad saying no to someone when they ask you to do something, if you label the feeling as guilt, you'll use a different map than if you see it as just setting an appropriate boundary where no means no, or just simply, thank you, but I have commitments for that time, and I'm not able to do it. If it's simply taking care of yourself. So, label something as guilt. you're going to have a very different mindset than if you determine or label it as a way of taking care of yourself. Here's another example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, "I'd like you to be the executor of my estate." And his daughter, my client, said, "Well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and wishes." And he said, "Well, that's none of your business." So we have to be aware of these things with our clients. So remember, the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each experience. So we need to recognize that a client is operating on their beliefs and listen for what those beliefs may be, or just at the baseline level, is it working? Is what they're doing working, or is there a better way? So, to map a new story, it may be helpful to navigate with the brain's error detection mechanism. We create patterns of connectedness in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict. Now, remember we talked about not just the default mode, but there's also the error detection mechanism in the brain that contributes to this discomfort from not doing what's usual, what the brain predicts and expects. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become hardwired and automatic. We notice then when something doesn't fit a predicted pattern. The error detection mechanism in the brain compares the input with what's expected. A mismatch creates a disruption in the flow, the expected order of things. So this error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamic factors. We notice differences more easily than confirmation. So it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong, and we struggle to list our strengths. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off an error detection response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before consideration. So this places another barrier to resist change. And this is part of why telling a client what to do, giving advice, suggestions, may trigger the error detection mechanism. And the error detection mechanism explains why we focus on problems and how that energizes, because it activates the error detection mechanism. So the mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, like for stress or certain aspects of childhood, may simply not apply in a current situation. Remember in the initial seminar, the word I incorporated or borrowed from psychoanalysis, this is from psychoanalysis, called transference, which simply means transferring some experiences, expectations, responses from the past to the present. What that means at a mind-brain level is we're simply using old software to process something currently and repeating it rather than pausing to reflect to see, is this really current? Is it going to work? Or even reflect, is this working? So this is how the error detection mechanism can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So the mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, stress, childhood, other situations, may or may not apply now. The hardwiring is not permanent. It can be revised. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, such as with collaborative, contingent conversations, which is exactly our mode of operation, new connections are made in the brain. new maps are created. This is also how, as we've touched on, and just to reiterate here, how automatic, even intuitive, instinctive decisions also need to be examined. Intuition, for example, operates at a midbrain level, forwarded to the left prefrontal cortex to make it make logical conscious sense and have awareness, but intuition is ghostwritten by the already existing mental models and the simulations created from them. So instinct can be misleading. And this is where we have to, intuition, for our part, we have to be sure that it's applicable to this person at this time. So here are 10, we'll come back to, let me just tell you a vivid example of this. A neuroscientist, somebody I collaborate with, is an avid mountain climber, and he was about to take on one of the major peaks of his life in Australia. He was so excited about it, and he was paired right, you know, at the base camp with a partner, a woman, and it was for him, from his experience, and he's a neuroscientist who not just dabbles but studies these kind of things. So this tells you how this does not grant any of us immunity. He thought he was in love. This was the person. I mean, he had been waiting for a lot, and he thought this was the one. And they had a powerfully passionate and engaging time in that climb. And he reflected just not too long after the climb. He recognized that he had, and he termed it, and he had written about this stuff, a misattribution of affect, of emotion. He attributed his emotion to the woman. Instead of recognizing it, recognizing that it was the excitement of the climb that he then experienced as if it were the co-creation of the two of them. And he realized shortly after the climb that he had made a mistake. She wasn't the one. And he recognized this process then in order to write about it. So this is the kind of thing, for example, you have an experience, you're beginning a new endeavor. You're taking a step into something you might not have done before or not feel confident about, and you get a signal from your brain that this is a step into the new, the different, the unknown. And that trepidation is an understandable, natural response from the error detection mechanism. Yet if you read it and interpret it in a way as if to say, well, you know, I'm an imposter, or I don't have confidence, I can't do it, that brings closure because it's like a diagnosis, but it's not causal and it's limiting. It's simply an understandable step that's next, that is not certain. And that trepidation and uncertainty is a register in your brain that this is something new and different in order to stick with your plan. That's why it doesn't take motivation to do something, just to plan and stick to it. But it also requires correct interpretation of the experiences in order to process and proceed in those experiences. This is exactly where we come into play to facilitate in that collaborative process to work with a client and help them understand this. So here are 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. I think these are helpful. These are not something that are going to make their way, hopefully, into your conversation with clients, but this is a way of thinking about things that can facilitate. One, change creates discomfort. That's exactly what we've been talking about. part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just trying to help someone decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior or any habit requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into our brain. Neuronal pathways and neuronal networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create effective operation, to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how to drive the same way to work every day, because after you do it for a while, it becomes a default mode, so you can think about other things or listen to an audio book. This default mode is energy efficient because the brain is freed up to do other things. It plays a major role in the evolution of our species. But when these habits are confronted and have to change, the autopilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort, like you can't go the usual way and listen to the audiobook. There's construction. You have to snake your way through the neighborhood. You have to put additional energy. You don't want to. If you could resist that change, you would. That's exactly what your client's brain is saying to that client every time you introduce a possibility, even of thinking about something in a different way. Nah, I'm just going to go the usual way. And or I'll say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, but I know I'm going to go back to, you know, I'm going to go back to the freeway, because that's way better than having to think about it. And I'm really into this book. So there's discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change, to preserve the default habit. The brain naturally resists change because it's already hardwired behavior to save energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs turn genes on or turn them off. And I've heard him say this in person. Ray Kurzweil wrote about this in The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Kurzweil said, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. He's one of the leaders currently in AI as well. Two, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, that's when the error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. Since this portion of the brain has the job description to recognize and correct errors, consider the emotional expense of a couple of things. One, a lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance, triple work. Also, what we've come to see very recently is when lies are repeated, they're not registered, repeated enough, they're not registered in the brain as a lie because they've been grooved. Another, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of the dissonance in your brain. Your error detection mechanism reads that you spent what you couldn't afford to buy. Then you have to pay the interest on the debt. Triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news, this neural machinery can recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we also respond to mistakes. Now, this is great. If we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and print out to change itself. And this is what I was referring to. The correct reading of this frames it. And the question, the determination, is this change or is this a mistake? That's also where we come into play as coaches. Now, we'll return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. 3, the brain is a prediction machine. If you have a paper and a pen, I want to give you some numbers. You want to write them down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. Look at them and tell me what's missing, or determine what's missing in that set of numbers. You know, usually 3 and 6, sometimes multiples of 3, those are all answers. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. J. Paul Getty says there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes. Listing 2 things and a 3rd non sequitur. Set up, help. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to, at times, override both emotion and brain patterns to make a wise and balanced decision. And we'll talk about that a bit more next time. I want to introduce, I have not talked, you probably will see why, I have not talked about this or written about this publicly yet, but I just developed it over the weekend at my ranch. It's called the Texas 3-Step. It's a way, the simplest way I can determine of how to respond to emotional stimuli. So stay tuned. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Think about this. You're the COO, the chief operating officer of a company, determining a policy about employees being on time. What do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? Well, the answer is neither. Remember, you get what you focus on. Both are likely to backfire. And studies show a couple of things. Threats can work short-term, but focuses attention on the mistake, away from work, back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually focuses on the same thing and can even raise anxiety and reinforce the neural patterns connected with lateness. Now, we assume people, our clients, for example, will receive information about change, suggestions, advice, even a suggestion camouflaged in the form of a question. Well, have you thought about... Not so, says the brain. The error detection mechanism reads, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. That can be a limiting assumption. Well, I need to get motivated to lose weight or to work out. Someone may not even generate what is read as motivation until setting a goal. An action can generate its own motivation. Many of the professional athletes and actors I've worked with, they get up in the morning, they go to the gym or whenever they go, they are not motivated to do it, but they do it every day because that's what they need to do in order to do what's next. So motivation isn't essential. The only two things that become essential, having a plan and sticking to it. The plan is the system. For example, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You have a plan. You set up an automatic payment or participation plan. You make a good choice one time, for example, to set up an automatic withdrawal from your checking account for X number of dollars the first of every month to put in your retirement plan. You don't have to be motivated. You don't have to make a decision that way except one time. Six, emotions can change brain functioning. Now, when emotions are triggered, brain chemicals of dopamine and or adrenaline are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. So this is why self-talk or willpower can be limiting. Change your thoughts to change your behavior may work until emotion gets activated. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. Now, I'm quoting someone you may have seen if you stayed up late enough. This last, like, 2-3 days ago on Netflix. He's one of the philosophers of the 21st century. And he put it quite simply. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. That was Mike Tyson. When there's possibility of reward, dopamine's released to produce an excited state in response to anticipation of a reward, a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine or a blackjack table. Well, here's what we know now. It's not the reward that causes this spike in dopamine. It's the anticipation. It's the anticipation of spending. It's the anticipation as someone is approaching the slot machine. When they're hooked up to an fMRI, there's a spike in dopamine before they ever touch the machine. Increased brain firing and dopamine spike precede what they do, for example, to spend money or to gamble or to anticipate what pleasure or state change they will have with a food, a drug, anything that creates anticipation. Also, research shows that anticipation of reward can be more satisfying than actually receiving it because attaining the goal shuts down that chemical engine of anticipation and the excitement of the dopamine that goes with it. So looking forward to the big win or the big purchase can actually be more thrilling than getting it. This can contribute to buyer's remorse, as well as the almost ubiquitous experience that the new purchase isn't as exciting as you may have anticipated. All this means is you're moving from the sprint system in your brain to the marathon system. And it can be a misread. For example, your client may have a lull after 2 or 3 months because all of the excitement of the things they needed to work on and the newness, and then they need to settle in to really make the changes, make them permanent. That can read as a kind of stagnation. So this is where we can be aware of this, because a client will naturally say, well, you know, I think I'm done, or I think I'm going to take a break now, instead of strapping their seatbelt for the long haul, longer haul at least, to go about the difficult process of change and the system that's been co-created ideally to do that. Seven, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, known as a little bit of stress, for example, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term can enhance learning, But the time window on this is up to maybe 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor certainly may not be their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay at one place in one position get most entrenched. For example, a place I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The founder passes the company that he or she founded 34 years ago to 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, job descriptions. These last two principles now, I think, are really huge. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. And two things above all others create neurogenesis, new brain cells: enhanced environment and exercise. And don't hang with me through the enhanced environment or enriched environment and fade at the exercise. You need to stick with both. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust. This is exactly what we do in coaching. The hippocampus is the part of the brain and the midbrain especially connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. Now, what's your guess about how much exercise increases cells? Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%, the site of creativity and memory. And these findings have been replicated more recently in University of Hamburg medical students and London taxicab drivers. Another related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus decrease with continuing stress. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region in the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can simply reassign job descriptions of neurons. It's like rezoning and developing cortical real estate. And that's been shown, for example, in one study, people who had a stroke and were paralyzed on one side, the usual response is to put the affected arm, if it's that, in a sling so there's no damage and no further insult. This study, which was the beginning of a new way of thinking about, put the good arm in a sling. So the person was necessarily using, if they did anything at all, with the arm that had been affected. And within 3 months, this showed dramatically different effects. Another example in terms of sort of rezoning cortical real estate, the braille, the finger used for braille by someone who's blind, has a significantly greater amount of brain anatomy devoted to that finger. Same with classical guitarists and a number of other studies. Now, here's an example, just quickly, of when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that reversed everything. Up was down was up, consistently 24 hours a day. So they had to learn to adjust everything they did, to be very careful and thoughtful about every movement. Then they noticed about day 25 for each something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustment. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had developed new neural pathways. Their brains had rewired. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. Notice the role of consistency. So the human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become automatic, so we don't even have to think about them. They're hardwired and automatic. So I'm going to ask you to bear with me here because I didn't save enough time for discussion. I want, and this is in your outline, I want to discuss in our last minutes the overview of mapping changes. There are six crucial elements to map change, and I think each of these are important. One is to regulate states of mind. This allows access to all of the software, for all of the states of mind, and to make a studied decision to respond rather than react. So this is the first order of business. We'll return to this as we talk about the Texas three-step next time. So with any kind of emotional stimulation, anything that will alter full access, anything that compromises being fully grounded and centered, the first order of business is to get grounded and centered. Number two element to map change is the power is in the focus. This is from neuroscience, quantum physics, and it's behind the law of attraction, although the law of attraction can mislead. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects a frequency. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel that you use. So this means that whatever we focus on aligns the energy field of our brain, and that alignment brings about the focus to begin to make it become more actual. You become what you think about, so put energy into what you want. Focus on possibilities instead of problems, desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it, to add energy to it. This can create resistance. But when you focus on what you don't want kind of falls away. It's like your lap when you get up to walk. This is the other component of change, is unfocus of what you disengage in order to solidify and integrate that. We'll come to that next time. And three, visualize changes. The prototype study, many, many years ago, basketball players at Ohio State divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of practice daily of free throws. Another group, they visualized shooting perfect free throws. Nothing but act, nothing but net. They were tested at the end of 30 days. The first group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice, 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. Third group, practice visualization only, 23% improvement. Now, I mentioned that's a prototype. Since then, the methods have been perfected a bit more, and visualization alone for something like this can actually surpass actual practice, because each time you miss, you got to counter that little bit of change in your brain and correct that with visualization, nothing but net. You got nothing to worry about. So on brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as with actually shooting. So create a vision, an image of your goal, then look back to see the path to get there. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. A vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. 4, insight changes the brain. A moment of insight, an aha experience on an fMRI study activates 3 different parts of the brain. And an aha, a moment of insight, vaults someone into a state of mind that's more synthetic and integrative and creative. So this is how we can help a client develop that insight. Compared, for example, when given information, a directive, an order, a suggestion, nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. So as important as this insight-induced change is, sustained attention and systematic ways of proceeding can hardwire it into the brain circuit. 5, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, a system, and set it into motion. Winners and losers have the same goal. Winners have a plan and systematically enact it. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from their mistakes and producing results. And 6, and an important aspect of this, transform identity. A new experience or new idea, every change that your client experiences, every step needs to be considered as a way also of transforming their operating system. This is the bedrock of their identity, of who and what they are. So when that transformation occurs into their operating system, this is what makes change permanent. Their identity evolves with those changes. This is not something just that they do, because if you just do it and don't transform identity, you'll revert back to the old way. When you inhabit the entire episode, you make it part of your self-experience. So in brief summary here, and we're over. I apologize for that. Hang with me for another minute and a half here. Some specific principles to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Develop self-awareness. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal network. You're not using this language, I hope, with clients, natural talents, behaviors, patterns, to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus is going to align energy field. It will enhance neuronal etching, so it needs to be on useful behaviors, responses. Correct mistaken couplings. Use, understand, and build existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, metaphors create maps. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. This will be exciting. The client, the brain says at least, but the client will say, nah, I don't want to change. So, the client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. This is the collaborative framework that you began. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. So this framework, I think, can help the client and help you and the client in your collaborative work together. My apologies for going over and not having discussion. We'll begin next time. I'll send out an email with some prompts for you to think about, maybe discuss, have questions about for our last seminar. Thanks very, very much, and I appreciate all the comments you made, the emails you've sent. Be sure to send me any questions or things that you want to be sure we cover in our final seminar. And thanks for indulging me to go over, and my apologies for that. See you next week. Thanks very, very much. See you guys.